Down again, and again. Barius falls to the white stones, the pool of blood around him spreading rapidly. His eyes flutter. I hope his mind is gone. I hope he can't feel it anymore. I make myself watch. This is why you're leaving, Elias. So you're never a part of this again. A gurgling moan trickles from Barius's mouth. The commandant drops her arm, and the courtyard is silent. I see the deserter breathing. In once, out, and then nothing. No one cheers. Dawn breaks, the sun's rays tracing the sky above Blackcliff's ebony bell tower like bloodied fingers, tinging everyone in the courtyard a lurid red. The commandant wipes her crop on Barius's fatigues before returning it to her belt.
Take him to the dunes, she orders the legionnaires. For the scavengers.
Then she surveys the rest of us.
Duty first, unto death. If you betray the Empire, you will be caught, and you will pay. Dismissed!
The lines of students dissolve. Dex, who brought the deserter in, slips away quietly, his darkly handsome face slightly sick. Faris lumbers after, no doubt to clap Dex on the back and suggest he forget his troubles at a brothel. Demetrius stalks off alone, and I know he's remembering that day, 2 years ago, when he was forced to watch his little brother die just like Barius. He won't be fit to speak with for hours. The other students drain out of the courtyard quickly, still discussing the whipping.
Only 30 lashes. What a weakling. Did you hear him gasping, like a scared girl? Elias.
Helene's voice is soft, as is the touch of her hand on my arm.
Come on. The commandant will see you.
She's right. Everyone is walking away. I should too. I can't do it. No one looks at Barius's bloody remains. He is a traitor. He is nothing. But someone should stay. Someone should mourn him, even if for a moment.
Elias,
Helene says, urgent now.
Move. She'll see you.
I need a minute, I reply.
You go on.
She wants to argue with me, but her presence is conspicuous, and I'm not budging. She leaves with a last backward glance. When she's gone, I look up to see the commandant watching me. We lock eyes across the long courtyard, and I am struck for the 100th time at how different we are. I have black hair. She has blonde. My skin glows golden brown, and hers is chalk white. Her mouth is ever disapproving, while I look amused even when I'm not. I am broad-shouldered and well over 6 feet, while she is smaller than a scholar woman even, with a deceptively willowy form. But anyone who sees us standing side by side can tell what she is to me. My mother gave me her high cheekbones and pale grey eyes. She gave me the ruthless instinct and speed that make me the best student Blackcliff has seen in 2 decades. Mother. It's not the right word. Mother evokes warmth and love and sweetness. Not abandonment in the tribal desert hours after birth. Not years of silence and implacable hatred. She's taught me many things, this woman who bore me. Control is one of them. I tamp down my fury and disgust, emptying myself of all feeling. She frowns, a slight twist of her mouth, and raises a hand to her neck, her fingers following the whorls of a strange blue tattoo poking out of her collar. I expect her to approach and demand to know why I'm still here, why I challenge her with my stare. She doesn't. Instead, she watches me for a moment longer, before turning and disappearing beneath the arches. The bell tower tolls 6, and the drums thud. All students report to mess. At the foot of the tower, the legionnaires heave up what's left of Barius and carry him away. The courtyard stands silent, empty except for me staring at a puddle of blood where a boy once stood, chilled by the knowledge that if I'm not careful, I'll end up just like him.
Chapter 5 Liar. The silence of the catacombs is as vast as a moonless night, and as eerie, which isn't to say that the tunnels are empty. As soon as I drop through the grate, a rat skitters across my bare feet, and a clear, fist-sized spider descends on a thread inches from my face. I bite my hand so I don't scream. Save Darin. Find the resistance. Save Darin. Find the resistance. Sometimes I whisper the words. Mostly I chant them in my head. They keep me moving, a charm to ward off the fear nipping at my mind. I'm not sure, really, what I should be looking for. A camp? A hideout? Any sign of life that isn't rodent in nature? Since most of the Empire's garrisons are located east of the Scholars' Quarter, I head west. Even in this sky's forsaken place, I can point unfailingly to where the sun rises and where it sets, to the Empire's capital in the north, Antium and Tenavium, its main port due south. It's a sense I've had for as long as I can remember. When I was a child, and Sarah should have seemed vast to me, I was always able to find my way. I take heart from it. At least I won't be wandering in circles. For a time, sunshine trickles into the tunnels through the catacomb grates, weakly lighting the floor. I hug the crypt-pocked walls, swallowing my revulsion at the reek of rotting bones. A crypt is a good place to hide if a martial patrol gets too close. Bones are just bones, I tell myself. A patrol will kill you. In the daylight, it's easier to push away my doubts and convince myself that I'll find the resistance. But I wander for hours, and eventually the light fades and night falls, dropping like a curtain over my eyes. With it, fear comes rushing into my mind, a river that's broken a dam. Every thump is a murderous ox soldier, every scritch a horde of rats. The catacombs have swallowed me as a python swallows a mouse. I shudder, knowing that I have a mouse's chance of survival down here. Save Darin. Find the resistance. Hunger gathers into a knot in my stomach, and thirst burns my throat. I spot a torch flickering in the distance, and feel a moth-like urge to head toward it. But the torches mark Empire territory, and the ox soldiers who get tunnel duty are probably plebeians, the most low-born of the marshals. If a group of plebes catches me down here, I don't want to think of what they'll do. I feel like a hunted, craven animal, which is exactly how the Empire sees me, how it sees all scholars. The Emperor says that we are a free people who live under his benevolence. But that's a joke. We can't own property or attend schools, and even the mildest transgression results in enslavement. No one else suffers such harshness. Tribesmen are protected under a treaty during the invasion. They accepted martial rule in exchange for free movement for their people. Mariners are protected by geography and the vast amounts of spices, meat, and iron they trade. In the Empire, only scholars are treated like trash. Then defy the Empire, liar. I hear Darin's voice. Save me. Find the resistance. The darkness slows my footsteps until I'm practically crawling. The tunnel I'm in narrows, the walls crowding closer. Sweat pours down my back and my whole body quakes. I hate small spaces. My breath echoes raggedly. Somewhere ahead, Water falls in a lonely drip. How many ghosts haunt this place? How many vengeful spirits roam these tunnels? Stop, liar. No such things as ghosts. As a child, I spent hours listening to tribal tale spinners weave their legends of the mythical fae, the Nightbringer and his fellow djinn, ghosts, ifrits, wraiths, and wights. Sometimes the tales spilled into my nightmares. When they did, it was Darin who calmed my fears. Unlike tribesmen, scholars are not superstitious, and Darin has always had a scholar's healthy skepticism. No ghosts here, liar. I hear his voice in my mind and close my eyes, pretending he's beside me, allowing myself to be reassured by his steady presence. No wraiths either. There's no such thing. My hand goes to my armlet, as it always does when I need strength. It's nearly black with tarnish, but I prefer it that way. It draws less attention. I trace the pattern in the silver, a series of connecting lines that I know so well I see it in my dreams. Mother gave me the armlet the last time I saw her, when I was 5. It's one of the few clear memories I have of her. The cinnamon scent of her hair, the sparkle in her storm sea eyes. Keep it safe for me, little cricket. Just for a week. Just until I come back. What would she say now, if she knew I'd kept the armlet safe but lost her only son? That I'd saved my own neck and sacrificed my brother's? Set it right. Save Darin. Find the resistance. I release the armlet and stumble on. Soon after, I hear the first sounds behind me. A whisper. The scrape of a boot on stone. If the crypts weren't silent, I doubt I'd have noticed. The sounds are so quiet. Too quiet for an ox soldier. Too furtive for the resistance. A mask. My heart thumps, and I whirl, searching the tarry blackness. Masks can prowl through darkness like this as easily as if they are part wraith. I wait, frozen, but the catacombs fall silent again. I don't move. I don't breathe. I hear nothing. Rat. It's just a rat. A really big one, maybe. When I dare to take another step, I catch a whiff of leather and wood smoke. Human smells. I drop and search the floor with my hands for a weapon, a rock, a stick, a bone, anything to fight off whoever is stalking me. Then tinder hits flint. A hiss splits the air, and a moment later, a torch catches fire with a whoosh. I stand, shielding my face with my hands, the impression of the flame pulsing behind my lids. When I force my eyes open, I make out a half-dozen hooded figures in a circle around me, all with loaded bows pointed at my heart. "Who are you?" one of the figures says, stepping forward. Though his voice is cool and flat as a legionnaire's, he doesn't have the breadth and height of a marshal. His bare arms are hard with muscle, and he moves with fluid grace. A knife rests in one hand like it's an extension of his body, and he holds the torch in his other. I try to find his eyes, but they're hidden beneath the hood.
"Speak."
After hours of silence, I can barely manage a croak. "I'm looking for..." Why didn't I think this through? I can't tell them I'm looking for the resistance. No one with half a brain would admit to seeking out the rebels.
"Check her," the man says when I don't go on.
Another of the figures, slight and womanly, slings her bow on her back. The torch sputters behind her, casting her face into deep shadow. She looks too small to be a marshal, and the skin of her hands doesn't have the dark hue of a mariner's. She's probably either a scholar or a tribeswoman. Maybe I can reason with her. "Please," I say, "let me..."
"Shut it," the man who'd spoken before says. "Sunna, anything?" Sana. A scholar name, short and simple. If she were Marshall, her name would have been Agrippina Cassius, or Chrysilla Araman, or something equally long and pompous. But just because she's a scholar doesn't mean I'm safe. I've heard rumors of scholar thieves lurking in the catacombs, popping through grates to grab, raid, and usually kill whoever is nearby before dropping back into their lair. Sana runs her hands over my legs and arms. An armlet, she says. Might be silver. I can't tell. You're not taking that! I jerk away from her, and a thief's bows, which had dropped a notch, come back up. Please, let me go. I'm a scholar. I'm one of you. Get it done, the man says. Then he signals to the rest of his band, and they begin to slip back into the tunnels. Sorry about this, Sana sighs, but she has a dagger in her hand now. I retreat a step. Don't. Please. I knot my fingers together to hide their tremor. It was my mother's. It's the only thing I have left of my family. Sana lowers the knife, but then the leader of the thieves calls to her and, seeing her hesitation, stalks toward us. As he does, one of his men signals to him. Keenan, heads up! Ox patrol! Pear and scatter. Keenan lowers his torch. If they follow, lead them away from base, or you'll answer for it. Sana, get the girl silver and let's go. We can't leave her, Sana says. They'll find her. You know what they'll do? Not our problem. Sana doesn't move, and Keenan shoves the torch into her hands. When he takes me by the arm, Sana gets between us. We need silver, yes, she says, but not from our own people. Leave her. The unmistakable, clipped cadence of martial voices carries down the tunnel. They haven't seen the torchlight yet, but they will in just a few seconds. Damn it, Sana! Keenan tries to go around the woman, but she shoves him away with surprising force, and her hood falls back. As the torchlight illuminates her face, I gasp. Not because she's older than I thought, or because of her fierce animosity, but because on her neck I see a tattoo of a closed fist raised high with a flame behind it. Beneath it, the word Izzat. You're... I can't get the words out. Keenan's eyes fall on the tattoo, and he swears. Now you've done it, he says to Sana. We can't leave her. If she tells them she saw us, they'll flood these tunnels until they find us. He puts out the torch with brute swiftness and grabs my arm, pulling me after him. When I stumble into his hard back, he jerks his head around, and for a second I catch the angry shine of his eyes. His scent, sharp and smoky, wafts over me. Keep quiet and watch your step. He's closer than I realized, his breath warm against my ear. Or I'll knock you senseless and leave you in one of the crypts. Now move. I bite my lip and follow, trying to ignore his threat, and instead focus on Sana's tattoo. Izzat. It's old Rai, the language spoken by scholars before the marshals invaded and forced everyone to speak Saren. Izzat means many things. Strength, honor, pride. But in the past century, it's come to mean something specific. Freedom. This is no band of thieves. It's the resistance.
Chapter 6 Elias. Varius's screams blister my brain for hours. I see his body fall, hear the rasp of his last breath, smell the taint of his blood on the flagstones. Student deaths don't usually hit me this way. They shouldn't. The Reaper's an old friend. He's walked with all of us at Blackcliff at some point. But watching Varius die was different. For the rest of the day, I'm short-tempered and distracted. My odd mood doesn't go unnoticed. As I trudge to combat training with a group of other senior skulls, I realize Paris has just asked me a question for a third time.
You look like your favourite whore's caught the pox,
he says when I mutter an apology.
What the hell is wrong with you?
Nothing. I realize too late how angry I sound, how unlike a skull on the verge of maskhood. I should be excited, bursting with anticipation. Farris and Dex trade a skeptical glance, and I stifle a curse.
You sure?
Dex asks. He's a rule follower, Dex. Always has been. Every time he looks at me, I know he's wondering why my mask hasn't joined with me yet.
Piss off,
I want to say to him. Then I remind myself that he's not prying. He's my friend, and he's genuinely worried.
This morning, he says, at the whipping, you were... Hey, leave the poor man be.
Aline strolls up behind us, flashing a smile at Dex and Farris, and throwing a careless arm around my shoulders as we enter the armory. She nods at a rack of Sims.
Go on, Elias. Pick your weapon. I challenge you. Best of three.
She turns to the others and murmurs something as I walk away. I lift a blunted practice Sim, checking its balance. A moment later, I feel her cool presence beside me.
What did you tell them?
I ask her.
That your grandfather's been hounding you.
I nod. The best lies come from the truth. Grandfather is a mask, and like most masks, he's never satisfied with anything less than perfection.
Thanks, Hel. You're welcome. Repay me by pulling yourself together.
She crosses her arms at my frown.
Dex is your platoon lieutenant, and you didn't commend him after he caught a deserter. He noticed. Your entire platoon noticed. And at the whipping, you weren't... with us.
If you're saying that I wasn't baying for the blood of a 10-year-old, you'd be right. Her eyes tighten, enough for me to know that some part of her sympathizes with me, even if she'll never admit it.
Marcus saw you stay behind after the whipping. He and Zack are telling everyone that you thought the punishment was too harsh.
I shrug, as if I care what the snake and toad say about me.
Don't be an idiot. Marcus would love to sabotage the heir to Jens Veturia a day before graduation.
She refers to my familial house, one of the oldest and most respected in the Empire, by its formal title.
He's all but accusing you of sedition.
He accuses me of sedition every other week.
But this time, you did something to earn it.
My eyes jerk to hers, and for one tense moment, I think she knows everything. But there's no anger or judgment in her expression, only concern. She counts off my sins on her fingers.
You're squad leader of the platoon on watch, yet you don't bring Barius in yourself. Your lieutenant does it for you, and you don't commend him. You barely contain your disapproval when the deserter's punished, not to mention the fact that it's the day before graduation, and your mask has only just begun to meld with you.
She waits for a response, and when I give none, she sighs.
Unless you're stupider than you look, even you can see how this appears, Elias. If Marcus reports you to the Black Guard, they might have enough evidence to pay you a visit.
A prickle of unease creeps down my neck. The Black Guard is tasked with ensuring the loyalty of the military. They wear the emblem of a bird, and their leader, once picked, gives up his name and is known simply as the Bloodstrike. He's the right hand of the Emperor and the second most powerful man in the Empire. The current Bloodstrike has a habit of torturing first and asking questions later. A midnight visit from those black-armored bastards will land me in the infirmary for weeks. My entire plan will be ruined. I try not to glare at Helene. Must be nice to believe so fervently in what the Empire spoon-feeds us.
Why can't I just be like her? Like everyone else?
Because my mother abandoned me. Because I spent the first 6 years of my life with tribesmen who taught me mercy and compassion instead of brutality and hatred. Because my playfellows were tribes' children, mariners and scholars instead of other illustrians. Hel hands me a sim.
Fall in, she says. Please, Elias, just for a day. Then we're free.
Right. Free to report for duty as full-fledged servants of the Empire, after which we'll lead men to their deaths in the never-ending border wars with wildmen and barbarians. Those of us not ordered to the border will be given city commands, where we'll hunt down resistance fighters or mariner spies. We'll be free, all right. Free to lord the Emperor. Free to rape and kill. Funny how that doesn't seem like freedom. I keep quiet. Helene's right. I'm drawing too much attention to myself, and Blackcliff is the worst place to do so. Students here are like starving sharks when it comes to sedition. One whiff of it, and they swarm. For the rest of the day, I do my best to act like a mask on the verge of graduation. Smug, brutish, violent. It's like covering myself in filth. When I return to my cell-like quarters in the evening for a precious few minutes of free time, I tear off my mask and toss it on my cot, sighing when the liquid metal releases its hold. At the sight of my reflection in the mask's polished surface, I grimace. Even with the thick black lashes that Farris and Dex love to mock, my eyes are so much my mother's that I hate seeing them. I don't know who my father is, and I no longer care. But for the 100th time, I wish that he'd at least given me his eyes. Once I escape the Empire, it won't matter. People will see my eyes and think Marshal instead of Commandant. Plenty of Marshals roam the South as merchants, mercenaries, and craftsmen. I'll be one among hundreds. Outside, the bell tower tolls 8. 12 hours until graduation. 13 until the ceremony is done. Another hour for pleasantries. Gens Veturia is a distinguished house, and Grandfather will want me to shake dozens of hands. But eventually, I'll beg off, and then... freedom. At last. No student has ever deserted after graduating. Why would they? It's the hell of Blackcliff that drives its students to run. But after we're out, we get our own commands, our own missions. We get money, status, respect. Even the lowest-born plebeian can marry high, if he becomes a mask. No one with any sense would turn his back on that, especially after nearly a decade and a half of training. Which is what makes tomorrow the perfect time to run. The 2 days after graduation are madness. Parties, dinners, balls, banquets. If I disappear, no one will think to look for me for at least a day. They'll assume I've drunk myself into a stupor at a friend's house. The passageway that leads from below my hearth into Sarah's catacombs pulses at the edge of my vision. It took me 3 months to dig out that damn tunnel. Another 2 months to fortify and hide it from the prying eyes of Orcs patrols, and 2 more months to map out the route through the catacombs and out of the city. 7 months of sleepless nights and peering over my shoulder and trying to act normal. If I escape, it will all have been worth it. The drums beat, signaling the start of the graduation banquet. Seconds later, a knock comes at my door. 10 hells. I was supposed to meet Helene outside the barracks, and I'm not even dressed yet. Helene knocks again.
Elias, stop curling your eyelashes and get out here. We're late.
Hang on, I say. As I pull off my fatigues, the door opens and Helene marches in. A blush blooms up her neck at my undressed state, and she looks away. I raise an eyebrow. Helene has seen me naked dozens of times, when wounded, or ill, or suffering through one of the Commandant's cruel strength training exercises. By now, seeing me stripped shouldn't cause her to do anything more than roll her eyes and throw me a shirt.
Hurry up, would you?
She fumbles to break the silence that's descended. I grab my dress uniform off a hook and button it on quickly, edgy at her awkwardness.
The guys already went ahead. Said they'd save us seats.
Aline rubs the Black Cliff tattoo on the back of her neck. A four-sided black diamond with curved sides that is inked into every student upon arrival at the school. Aline took it better than most of our class fellows, stoic and tearless, while the rest of us whimpered. The augurs have never explained why they only choose one girl per generation for Blackcliff, not even to Helene. Whatever the reason, it's clear they don't select at random. Helene might be the only girl here, but there's a reason she's ranked third in our class. It's the same reason that bullies learned early on to leave her alone. She's clever, swift, and ruthless. Now, in her black uniform, with her shining braid encircling her head like a crown, she's as beautiful as winter's first snow. I watch her long fingers at her nape, watch her lick her lips. I wonder what it would be like to kiss that mouth, to push her to the window and press my body against hers, to pull out the pins in her hair, to feel its softness between my fingers.
Elias?
Hmm? I realize I've been staring and snap out of it.
Fantasizing about your best friend, Elias. Pathetic.
Sorry, just... tired. Let's go. Hell gives me a strange look and nods at my mask, still sitting on the bed.
You might need that.
Right. Appearing without one's mask is a whipping offense. I haven't seen any skull maskless since we were 14. Other than Hell, none of them have seen my face either. I put the mask on, trying not to shudder at the eagerness with which it attaches to me. 1 day left. Then I'll take it off forever. The sunset drums thunder as we emerge from the barracks. The blue sky deepens to violet, and the searing desert air cools. Evening's shadows blend with the dark stones of Blackcliff, making the blockish buildings appear unnaturally large. My eyes rove the shadows, seeking out threats, a habit from my years as a fiver. I feel, for an instant, as if the shadows are looking back at me. But then the sensation fades.
Do you think the augurs will attend graduation?
Hell asks. No, I want to say. Our holy men have better things to do, like locking themselves up in caves and reading sheep entrails. Doubt it, is all I say.
I guess it would get tedious after 500 years.
Helene says this without a trace of irony, and I wince at the sheer idiocy of the idea. How can someone as intelligent as Helene actually think the augurs are immortal? But then, she's not the only one. Marshals believe that the augurs' power comes from being possessed by the spirits of the dead. Masks, in particular, revere the augurs, for it is the augurs who decide which marshal children will attend Blackcliff. It is the augurs who give us our masks, and we're taught that it was the augurs who raised Blackcliff in a single day, 5 centuries ago. There are only 14 of the red-eyed bastards, but on the rare occasions that they appear, everyone defers to them. Many of the Empire's leaders, generals, the Bloodshrike, even the Emperor, make a yearly pilgrimage to the augurs' mountain lair, seeking counsel on matters of state. And though it's clear to anyone with an ounce of logic that they are a pack of charlatans, they're lionized throughout the Empire, not just as immortal, but as oracles and mind-readers. Most Blackcliff students only see the augurs twice in our lives, when we're chosen for Blackcliff and when we're given our masks. But Helene has always had a particular fascination with the holy men. It's no surprise that she hoped they'd come to graduation. I respect Helene, but on this we don't agree. Martial myths are as believable as tribal fables of Jin and the Nightbringer. Grandfather is one of the few masks who doesn't believe in augur rubbish, and I repeat his mantra in my head. The field of battle is my temple. The sword point is my priest. The dance of death is my prayer. The killing blow is my release. The mantra is all I've ever needed. It takes all my control to hold my tongue. Helene notices.
Elias, she says, I'm proud of you.
Her tone is strangely formal.
I know you've struggled. Your mother...
She glances around and drops her voice. The Commandant has spies everywhere.
Your mother's been harder on you than any of the rest of us. But you showed her. You worked hard. You did everything right.
Her voice is so sincere that for a moment I waver. In 2 days, she won't think such things. In 2 days, she will hate me. Remember, Barius. Remember what you'll be expected to do after graduation. I jostle her shoulder.
Are you turning sappy and girly on me? Forget it, swine.
She punches me on the arm.
I was just trying to be nice.
My laugh is falsely hearty. They'll send you to hunt me down when I run. You and the others, the men I call brothers. We reach the mess hall, and the cacophony within hits us like a wave. Laughter and boasts and the raucous talk of 3,000 young men on the verge of leave or graduation. It's never this loud when the Commandant is in attendance, and I relax marginally, glad to avoid her. Hel pulls me to one of the dozens of long tables, where Faris is regaling the rest of our friends with a tale of his latest escapade at the riverside brothels. Even Demetrius, ever haunted by his dead brother, cracks a smile. Faris leers, glancing between us suggestively.
You two took your time.
Vittorius was making himself pretty just for you.
Hel shoves Faris's boulder-like body over, and we sit.
I had to drag him away from his mirror.
The rest of the table hoots, and Leander, one of Hel's soldiers, calls for Faris to finish his story. Beside me, Dex is arguing with Hel's second lieutenant, Tristus. He's an earnest, dark-haired boy, with a deceptively innocent look to his wide blue eyes, and his fiancée's name, Aelia, tattooed in block letters on his bicep. Tristus leans forward.
The Emperor's nearly 70, and he has no male issue. This year might be the year. The year the augurs choose a new emperor. A new dynasty. I was talking to Aelia about it.
Every year someone thinks it's the year.
Dex rolls his eyes.
Every year it's not. Elias, tell him. Tell Tristus he's an idiot.
Tristus, you're an idiot.
But the augurs say...
I snort quietly, and Helene gives me a sharp look.
Keep your doubts to yourself, Elias.
I busy myself with piling food on 2 plates and shove one toward her. Here, I say, have some slop.
What is it, anyway?
Hel pokes at the mash and takes a tentative sniff.
Cow dung?
No whining,
Faris says through a mouthful of food.
Pity the fivers. They have to come back to this after 4 years of happily robbing farmhouses.
Pity the yearlings,
Demetrius counters.
Can you imagine another 12 years? 13?
Across the hall, most of the yearlings smile and laugh like everyone else. But some watch us, the way starving foxes might watch a lion, hungry for what we have. I imagine half of them gone, half the laughter silenced. Half the body's cold. But that is what will happen in the years of deprivation and torment ahead of them. And they will face it either by living or dying, either by accepting or questioning. The ones who question are usually the ones who die. They don't seem to care much about Barius. The words are out of my mouth before I can help myself. Beside me, Aline's body stiffens like water freezing into ice. Dex frowns in disapproval, a comment dying on his lips, and silence falls across our table.
Why would they be upset?
Marcus, sitting one table away with Zack and a knot of cronies, speaks up.
That scum got what he deserved. I only wish he'd lasted longer so he could have suffered more. No one asked what you think, Snake,
Aline says.
Anyway, kid's dead now.
Lucky him.
Barris picks up a forkful of food and lets it plop unappetizingly back onto his steel plate.
At least he doesn't have to eat this swill anymore.
A low chuckle runs up and down the table, and conversation picks up again. But Marcus smells blood, and his malevolence taints the air. Zack turns his gaze to Helene and mutters something to his brother. Marcus ignores him, fixing his hyena eyes on me.
You were damn broken up over that traitor this morning, Veturius. Was he a friend? Piss off, Marcus. Been spending a lot of time down in the catacombs, too. What is that supposed to mean?
Helene's hand is on her weapon, and Farris grabs her arm. Marcus ignores her.
You gonna do a runner, Veturius?
My head comes up slowly.
It's a guess. He's guessing. There's no way he could know. I've been careful, and careful at Blackcliff translates to paranoid for most people.
Silence falls at my table, at Marcus's.
Deny it, Elias. They're waiting.
You were squad leader on watch this morning, weren't you?
Marcus says.
You should have been thrilled to see that traitor go down. You should have brought him in. Say he deserved it, Veturius. Say Barius deserved what he got.
It should be easy. I don't believe it, and that's what matters. But my mouth won't move. The words won't come. Barius didn't deserve to be whipped to death. He was a child, a boy so afraid of staying at Blackcliff that he'd risked everything to escape it. The silence spreads. A few centurions look up from the head table. Marcus stands, and, quick as a flood, the mood of the hall changes, turning curious and expectant.
Son of a whore.
Is this why your mask hasn't joined with you?
Marcus says.
Because you're not one of us. Say it, Veturius. Say the traitor deserved his fate.
Elias,
Aline whispers. Her eyes plead.
Fall in, just for one more day.
He...
Say it, Elias. Doesn't change anything if you do.
He deserved it.
I meet Marcus's eyes coolly, and he grins, like he knows how much the words cost.
Was that so hard, bastard?
I'm relieved when he insults me. It gives me the excuse I've wanted so badly. I spring toward him, fists first. But my friends are expecting it. Farris, Demetrius, and Helene are on their feet, holding me back, an irritating wall of black and blonde keeping me from beating that damn grin off Marcus's face.
No, Elias, Helene says. The Commandant will whip you for starting a fight. Marcus isn't worth that. He's a bastard. That'd be you, actually,
Marcus says.
At least I know who my father is. I wasn't raised by a pack of camel-stroking tribesmen.
You plebeian trash.
Senior Skulls!
The Sim Centurion has made his way to the foot of the table.
Is there a problem?
No, sir,
Aline says.
Go, Elias,
she murmurs.
Go get some air. I'll handle this.
My blood's still burning. I shove through the mess doors and find myself in the bell tower courtyard before I even know where I'm going. How the hell did Marcus figure out that I'm going to desert? How much does he know? Not too much, or I'd have been called to the Commandant's office by now. Damn him! I'm close. So close! I paced the courtyard, trying to calm myself. The desert heat has faded, and a crescent moon hangs low on the horizon, thin and red as a cannibal's smile. Through the arches, Sarah's lights glow dully, tens of thousands of oil lamps dwarfed by the vast darkness of the surrounding desert. To the south, a pool of smoke mutes the shine of the river. The smell of steel and forge wafts past, ever present in a city known solely for its soldiers and weaponry. I wish I could have seen Sarah before all this, when it was capital of the Scholar Empire. Under the scholars, the great buildings were libraries and universities instead of barracks and training halls. The street of storytellers was filled with stages and theatres, instead of an arms market where the only stories told now are of war and death. It's a stupid wish, like wanting to fly. For all their knowledge of astronomy and architecture and mathematics, the scholars crumbled beneath the Empire's invasion. Sarah's beauty is long gone. It's a martial city now. Above, the heavens glow, the sky pale with starlight. Some long-buried part of me understands that this is beauty, but I am unable to wonder at it, the way I did when I was a boy. Back then, I clambered up spiky jack trees to get closer to the stars, sure that a few feet of height would help me see them better. Back then, my world had been sand and sky and the love of Tribe Scythe, who saved me from exposure. Back then, everything was different.
All things change, Elias Vittorius. You are no boy now, but a man, with a man's burden upon your shoulders, and a man's choice ahead of you.
My knife is in my hands, though I don't remember drawing it, and I hold it to the throat of the hooded man beside me. Years of training keep my arm steady as a rock, but my mind races. Where had the man come from? I'd swear on the lives of everyone in my platoon that he hadn't been standing there a moment ago. Who the hell are you? He pulls down his hood, and I have my answer. Augur.
Chapter 7 Liar. We race through the catacombs, Keenan ahead of me, Sana at my heels. When Keenan is convinced we've left the Ox Patrol behind, he slows our pace and barks at Sana to blindfold me. I flinch at the harshness in his tone. This is what's become of the Resistance, this band of thugs and thieves. How did it happen?
Only 12 years ago, the rebels were at the height of their power, allying themselves with the tribes and the King of Marin.
They'd lived their code. Izzat, fighting for freedom, protecting the innocent, elevating loyalty to their own people above all else. Does the Resistance remember that code anymore? On the off chance that they do, will they help me? Can they help me? You'll make them help you. Darren's voice again, confident and strong, like when he taught me to climb a tree, like when he taught me to read. We're here, Sana whispers after what feels like hours. I hear a series of knocks and the scrape of a door opening. Sana guides me forward, and a burst of cool air washes over me, fresh as spring after the stench of the catacombs. Light creeps through the edges of my blindfold. The rich green smell of tobacco curls up into my nose, and I think of my father, smoking a pipe as he drew pictures of a Fritz and whites for me. What would he say if he saw me now, in a Resistance hideout? Voices mutter and murmur. Warm fingers tangle in my hair, and a moment later my blindfold falls away. Keenan is right behind me.
Sana, he says. Give her some neem leaf,
and get her out of here. He turns to another fighter, a girl a few years older than me, who flushes when he speaks to her. Where's Mazin? Have Raj and Navid reported yet? What's Neemleaf? I ask Sana, when I'm sure Keenan can't hear. I've never heard of it, and I know most herbs from working with Pop. It's an opiate. It'll make you forget the last few hours. At my widening eyes, she shakes her head. I won't give it to you. Not yet, anyway. Have a seat. You look a mess. The cavern we're in is so dark, it's hard to tell how big it is. Blue fire lanterns, usually found in the finest illustrian neighborhoods, glow here and there with pitch torches flickering between them. Clean night air flows through a constellation of gaps in the rock ceiling, and I can barely make out the stars. I must have been in the catacombs for nearly a day. It's drafty. Sana pulls off her cloak, and her short, dark hair tufts out like a disgruntled bird's. But it's home. Sana, you're back. A stocky, brown-haired man approaches, looking at me curiously. Tarik, Sana greets him. We ran into a patrol, picked up someone on the way. Grab us some food, would you? Tarik disappears, and Sana gestures for me to sit on a nearby bench, ignoring the stares coming our way from the dozens of people moving about the cavern. There are an equal number of men and women here, most in dark, close-fitting clothing, and nearly all dripping with knives and sims, as if expecting an empire raid any moment. Some sharpen weapons, others watch over cook fires. A few older men smoke pipes. The bunks along the cabin wall are filled with sleeping bodies. As I look around, I push a hank of hair out of my face. Sana's eyes narrow when she takes in my features. You look familiar, she says. I allow my hair to fall forward again. Sana's old enough to have been in the resistance for quite some time, old enough to have known my parents. I used to sell Nan's jams at market. Right. She's still staring. You live in the quarter. Why is she still here? Keenan, who's been busy with a group of fighters in the corner, approaches, pulling back his hood. He's far younger than I expected, closer to my age than Sana's, which might explain why she bristles at his tone. Flame-red hair spills over his forehead and into his eyes, so dark at the roots it's almost black. He's only a few inches taller than me, but lean and strong, with a scholar's even, fine features. A hint of ginger stubble shadows his jaw, and freckles spatter his nose. Like the other fighters, he wears nearly as many weapons as a mask. I realize I'm staring and glance away, heat rising in my cheeks. Suddenly, the looks he's been getting from the younger women in the cavern make sense. She can't stay, he says. Get her out of here, Sana. Now. Tarik returns and, overhearing Keenan, slams a plate of food onto the table behind me. You don't tell her what to do. Sana's not some besotted recruit. She's the head of our faction, and you... Tarik. Sana puts a hand on the man's arm, but the look she gives Keenan could wither stone. I was giving the girl some food. I wanted to find out what she was doing in the tunnels. I was looking for you, I say. For the resistance? I need your help. My brother was taken in a raid yesterday. We can't help, Keenan says. We're stretched thin as it is. But we can't help. He speaks slowly as if I'm a child. Maybe before the raid, the chill in his eyes would have silenced me. But not now. Not when Darren needs me. You don't lead the resistance, I say. I'm second in command. He's higher up than I expected, but not high enough. I shake my hair out of my face and stand. Then it's not up to you, whether I stay or not. It's up to your leader. I try to sound brave, Although if Keenan disagrees, I don't know what I'll do. Start begging, maybe? Sana's smile is sharp as a knife. Girl's got a point. Keenan moves toward me until he's standing uncomfortably close. He smells of lemon and wind and something smoky, like cedar. He takes me in from head to toe, and the look would be shameless if it wasn't for the slight puzzlement in his face, like he's seeing something he doesn't quite understand. His eyes are a dark secret, black or brown or blue, I can't tell. It feels as if they can see right through me to my weak, cowardly soul. I cross my arms and look away, embarrassed of my tattered shift, of the dirt, the cuts, the damage.
That's an unusual armlet.
He reaches out a hand to touch it. The tip of his finger grazes my arm, sending a spark skittering across my skin, and I jerk away. He doesn't react.
So tarnished. I might not have noticed it.
It's silver, isn't it? I didn't steal it, all right? My body aches and my head spins, but I bunch my fists, afraid and angry all at once. And if you want it, you'll have to kill me to get it. He meets my eyes coolly, and I hope he doesn't call my bluff. He and I both know that killing me wouldn't be particularly difficult.
I expect I would, he says. What's your name?
Lyra. He doesn't ask for a family name. Scholars rarely take them. Sana looks between us, bemused.
I'll go get Maz. No,
Keenan's already walking away.
I'll find him.
I sit back down, and Sana keeps glancing at my face, trying to puzzle out why I look familiar. If she'd seen Darren, she'd have known right away. He's a spitting image of our mother, and no one could forget mother. Father was different, always in the background, drawing, planning, thinking. He gave me his unruly midnight hair and gold eyes, his high cheekbones and full, unsmiling lips. In the quarter, no one knew my parents. No one looked twice at Darren or me. But a resistance camp is different. I should have realized that. I find myself staring at Sana's tattoo, and my stomach lurches at the sight of the fist and flame. Mother had one just like it, above her heart. Father spent months perfecting it before inking it into her skin. Sana sees me staring. When I got this tattoo, the resistance was different, she explains without my asking. We were better. But things changed. Our leader, Mazin, told us we needed to be bolder, to go on the attack. Most of the young fighters, the ones Mazin trains, tend to agree with that philosophy. It's clear Sana's not happy about this. I'm waiting for her to say more when a door opens on the far side of the cabin to admit Keenan and a limping, silver-haired man.
Lawyer, Keenan says. This is Mazin. He's...
leader of the resistance. I know his name, because my parents spoke it often when I was a child. And I know his face because it's on wanted signs all over Sarah.
So, you're our orphan of the day?
The man comes to a stop before me, waving me back down when I rise to greet him. He has a pipe clenched in his teeth, and the smoke blurs his ravaged face. The resistance tattoo, faded but still visible, is a blue-green shadow on the skin below his throat.
What is it you want?
My brother Darren's been taken by a mask. I watch Mazin's face carefully to see if he recognizes my brother's name. But he gives nothing away. Last night, in a raid at our house, I need your help to get him back.
We don't rescue strays.
Mazin turns to Keenan.
Don't waste my time again.
I try to quash my desperation. Darren's no stray. He wouldn't have even been taken if it wasn't for your men.
Mazin swings around. My men? two of your fighters were interrogated by the marshals. They gave Darin's name to the Empire before they died. When Mazin looks at Keenan for confirmation,